We've performed here at Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park 3 times, 2002, 2005, and now 2013. The last time we were here, I wasn't doing a podcast. And the last time I was here in 2005, Blake Robinson, you weren't here either.
I was not. I was in Washington, D.C.
So welcome to the Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park, Blake.
Well, thank you. I should be asking you, you know, how it's going, because you've been here far, far longer than I have.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 368, The Cincinnati Playhouse. The last 2 times we performed here at Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park, Ed Stern was the artistic director, but Ed's retired and Blake Robinson is now in his second year as the new artistic director. Prior to taking the reins here, Blake was producing artistic director at the Roundhouse Theater in Washington, D.C. and founded Vermont Stage, and was a director and leader at several other fine institutions. And as we begin our final week of performances of the complete history of comedy abridged, Blake was good enough to sit down with me and talk about the Cincinnati Playhouse in the Park and how, if at all, the place has changed.
One of the things that I instantly noticed when we came back was that so many of the same faces are here as were here the last 2 times you were here. So you didn't come in to become the new artistic director of Cincinnati Playhouse and immediately clean house and bring in, you know, do you know what I mean? So that wasn't part of your thing.
No. Some people do that when they go to a new theater, but my position throughout the interview and even my early time here is that this is not a theater that needs to be fixed. It's not a fixer-upper. It's not a place that's in any kind of personnel crisis, certainly not in any kind of financial crisis. Yeah. It's a very stable institution. And what you know, because you just said it and you've experienced it, is that the staff here have been here for a very long time. And I always think that's a sign of a healthy institution.
Yeah.
People love working here. Yeah. They're committed to this community and this audience, and so having such an adult professional staff was a real attraction for me. I'm used to working at theaters where, you know, I and one or two other senior people are the oldest people there, you know, by 20 or 30 years, and then everybody else is a 20-something who's fighting the good fight and doing it because they love art and getting by on very, very subsistence-level salaries.
Yeah.
And that's not the case here at the Playhouse. It's a mature, robust institution. I think people feel respected and listened to, and we reap the benefits of it.
Yeah. Well, and then in that sense, is that in a little sense daunting then? Because you might, oh my God, all I can do is screw this up.
It was a little daunting at first. I tell you, I love and respect my predecessor, Ed Stern, who made this place what it is. This is absolutely the house that Ed built.
Yeah.
That said, if I had a quarter for every time somebody came up to me in the lobby last year and said, you know, you have very big shoes to fill. And it's absolutely true, and they made sure to remind me of it.
I bet constantly.
Constantly. Yeah. Ed's been an extraordinary gentleman throughout the whole transition, and now here we are midway through my second year. It feels very, very comfortable. I think I have gotten used to the community. They have a better understanding of who I am and what sort of theater I'm interested in. And again, that we're not remaking the place.
Right.
We're simply trying to kind of reach out to all the audiences that are out there and make sure that everybody feels like there's something for them at the Playhouse.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people love your stuff, and other people will prefer the Shakespeare or the musical or the revival.
Right.
Some people come to everything. We love those people.
Yeah, yes, we do.
You know, the variety has always been the hallmark of a Playhouse season, as it is for most flagship regional theaters.
Sure.
And so we need to keep that going.
Well, and how do you... So this is an institution. It's won 2 Tony Awards. It's ongoing, as you say. It's incredibly healthy. How do you articulate your artistic vision as it fulfills the playhouses? And did you, or do you, have to adjust your artistic vision to suit the needs of the Playhouse?
No, because I like lots of different material. Yeah. You know, I don't think of myself as just a new play guy or just a Shakespeare guy or just a musical guy.
Mm-hmm.
I have been fortunate to run a number of theaters, and so I've been able to practice my own directorial vision, my own artistry in all those different arenas. And that's fun for me. So I don't feel like I need to push it so entirely in any one direction.
Well, and, you know, part of the artistry of being an artistic director is the administrative, the managerial, the hand-holding, the supervising of all of those things. Did that come naturally to you, or is that something you had to learn?
I think it did come naturally to me. I think it's because I grew up in an academic household. My father was president of a college, Middlebury College in Middlebury, Vermont, when I was a kid. So I grew up in that, not just a campus environment, but I grew up in the president's house on this little bucolic New England campus. And there were faculty parties and VIP guests and academics and donors and a lot of ceremony, you know, kind of commencements and things like that. So I was surrounded by that all the time. Right. And I watched my father do it in a nonprofit situation, a very different kind of nonprofit. But I was just kind of immersed in that world. I didn't know that I could do that myself. I started off as an actor, as many of us do.
And the smartest of us get out of that really quickly.
Well, I had the opportunity to leave New York, where I was kind of nurturing an early acting career, and move back to my home state of Vermont and start a theater there. And that's when I discovered that I had even more fun producing and eventually directing. And that opened up this other skill set. It's absolutely true that these days, artistic directors need to spend just as much time fundraising and schmoozing and doing the administrative work and the community work, the PR. I've always enjoyed that stuff. I think there are other generations of folks for whom that was not part of the deal originally. In the older, the early days of the regional theater, there were true artists, you know, people who were 100% grade A artists,
and who would not sully themselves with the banal.
No. They had somebody else to do that.
Yes, right.
You know, the landscape has changed. The institutions are perhaps a little bit more complex. Certainly, society is more complex, and there's so many more offerings out there competing for people's time and attention and entertainment dollars that you have to embrace all that kind of stuff. So I know some brilliant, brilliant directors who don't necessarily have the skill set to lead a big institution because of all those other things. And I suppose, because this is a comedy broadcast, I can say in all seriousness, I also know some really, really excellent artistic directors who aren't such good directors at the end of the day.
Yes, I've run into one or two of those myself. In fact, I served under one. You said that you discovered that producing and directing was even more fun. Can you articulate in what way those things were more fun or additional fun than just, in air quotes, acting?
Sure. I loved acting, and that's all I ever wanted to be. When I got out of college and then out of my drama program and moved to New York, and I think by any 22-year-old's measure, I was off and running, kind of building a career. And I had my process, and I felt confident in that process, like I could hold my own with anybody. But when I started directing and producing, I felt like the learning curve was so enormous that every time I did it, I was taking huge learning steps forward. And I guess the truth is I had ceased to feel that way in my acting. Acting was still fun and everything, but I kind of felt like, okay, I know how I do this. And even to this day, now I've been directing for 20 years professionally. I haven't acted in a very long time, but every time I start directing a play, I feel like that learning curve is still there.
That's true. Because there's the thing that you want to get better at. And you want to pursue that. I always find, too, that there are so many roles as an actor that I'm completely unfit for and will never, ever play. But I always feel like as a director, at least if I cast the right actor and work with him or her well, I have a little bit of a say in the creation of that character.
And you can go back to a script as a director many times if you're lucky enough to have the opportunity, and presumably as you grow older, you have a different point of view, a different vantage point on the material. Not so if you're acting. Yeah. And you can only play Romeo for so long until yes, you become true. An absurd Romeo like the ones in your shows.
Exactly, yes. Yeah, they're the only kinds of Shakespeare characters that we do are absurd.
Yeah, you know, I directed a production of The Winter's Tale by Shakespeare at the Folger Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C. Sure. And I was so thrilled. It's such a wonderfully difficult and complex place. And I want to do a hard one, you know, I don't want to do an easy one. And in retrospect, you know, kind of Monday morning quarterbacking, I think I kind of wrestled the play to a draw. And maybe that's not so bad for the first time out. But as a director, I'm confident that I'll have at least one and maybe two more shots at that before I, you know, hang up my, my directing prompt book or whatever.
Do you feel like at a certain point that's the kind of a play that you can direct better as a 50-year-old director than a 25-year-old director?
I imagine so.
Just because of life?
Yeah, you hear people saying that when they come back to it for the third, fourth, fifth time. I have a friend who's directed Midsummer Night's Dream 14, 18 times.
Golly.
But every time, I mean, he finds something new and something fresh in it.
Boy, I hope so. It's not just the Ariel wearing high top sneakers.
No, I think that he's really good at pulling the wool over.
Hi, I'm Brian Dennehy. You're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This is our last week of performances in 2013. We close the complete history of Comedy Abridged this Sunday night, December 29th. But the first half of 2014 will be incredibly busy for us on two continents. We'll perform in the U.S. in Davidson, North Carolina, Laguna Beach, California, La Crosse and Green Bay, Wisconsin, and Lowell, Massachusetts. And we'll begin our three-month, 60-city tour of the Bible, the Complete Word of God Abridged in the U.K. on January 20th, 2014. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information.
What do you anticipate in the years to come for Cincinnati Playhouse in terms of the upcoming season?
Right. Well, we were talking before about artistic vision, and my vision always has to do with how the institution interacts with the community. So it's not a vision about achieving a particular height or a particular subscription number or anything like that. Right. I think it's something that has to do with human interaction, with the reasons we come to the theater in the first place. So what I've tried to do is look at where the Playhouse is now and get to know the Cincinnati community. Kind of finished my year-long listening tour to everybody. And
now you're on your second year shut up tour.
That's right. Trying to lay out some areas of focus for us. As I said, we're going to continue to do the wide variety of programming. But within that world, I feel that we have some growth areas that can make us a more healthy, robust institution for many, many, many years to come. So we're going to continue to focus on new plays. There's a long history here of doing new work. This is a world premiere that you guys are performing right now. We have two others in the season. Yeah. Three world premieres at a regional theater is a big deal.
Yeah.
And we've always done at least one a year, and usually two, sometimes three. That's going to continue because the perpetuation of the art form depends on it. And it does bring in a certain amount of new audience. There are people who really, really want to see the new stuff.
But that's good because I've talked to other artistic directors who say advertising something as a world premiere is not necessarily a selling point for some audiences.
That's true for some audiences, but for others it is.
But for you guys it is.
That's right. And we're fortunate in that we do so many productions here.
Yeah.
I mean, we have a 10 production subscription season, plus Christmas Carol, plus three touring shows. So between the 14 productions, we have so many ways to reach out into that community.
Yeah.
The second area of priority is to reach out to multi-generational and family audiences. We opened my first season with a big, fun production of Three Musketeers. And over 40% of the single tickets sold were to youth and kids who were there with their parents, many of whom came for the first time. So like A Christmas Carol later on, it's a point of entry for people.
Right.
And one hopes that they have a great experience at the Playhouse and then they want to come back to something else.
Yeah.
And for those young people, you're getting them excited about the live theater experience.
Absolutely.
And hoping that that will stay with them for decades to come. Beyond that, we have a continued commitment to doing culturally diverse works on our stage, not just African-American, but also diversity in the sense of plays that speak to different generations, mm-hmm. plays that speak to a number of different groups of cultural backgrounds. So these are all things the Playhouse has always done.
Yeah.
But I'm just making them front burner issues.
Right, right.
So that they become programming priorities for us.
And well, and that becomes, it seems like those things, as you articulate, that become more of the talking points for everybody in the institution, from the box office to the house managers to everybody. So everybody's on the same page about all that.
Absolutely. And and we're seeing very strong early results from those things.
What are those results? Can you, because it seems like some of what you're talking about is the quality of a conversation, which can be ephemeral and hard to quantify.
Right.
Is it all just ticket sales? That's how you measure it?
No, of course, that's the traditional measurement, yeah. right? Ticket sales and subscriptions. But I like to think of it more as what sorts of interactions, you know, quality interactions do we have with people? That could be something as simple as someone coming in here in order to see A Christmas Carol and realizing that they can come back for Clybourne Park and have a post-show discussion about a play that has something very, very meaningful to say about what's going on in terms of real estate and economic development right here in Cincinnati. Or they realize that we offer a summer camp for their kid.
Yeah.
I think we used to put so much value on the sale and the subscription that we didn't value some of those other things quite as much.
Some of the people who don't subscribe but are in here a lot through a variety of your programs.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, the subscribers themselves have changed, too. You know, people who used to come to all 10 subscription shows now often cherry-pick their way through, and they'll pick the 4, 5, 7 that they like best, these so-called build-your-own subscriptions.
Right.
It's been very successful at theaters all over the country. It's important that you give people the choice and the variety. But one of the aspects of kind of live entertainment that kind of falls into is the sense that everybody is a sampler now.
Yeah.
I think in the old days, you signed up for the full boat because you believed in the theater and you thought it was important. There's so many things competing for our time now that I worry sometimes people have become samplers.
Right.
And they're only willing to sample things that they are predisposed to like.
Yeah.
I worry that we've lost a sense of adventurousness, a sense of curiosity about our arts going. And that what that means is that there's no longer a single Playhouse audience.
Yeah.
There is a variety of affinity groups. People who like comedy, people who like drama, people who like musicals, people who like the Shakespeare play. It goes on and on and on. And now you're having to have conversations with all of those people simultaneously throughout the year instead of a single conversation with a monolithic audience. It's not a good thing or a bad thing, ultimately.
Yeah.
It's just the way society is now, and so we have to grow and adapt.
Well, and any good director can speak to a number of different actors in whatever language they best receive information in, so I guess it's the same as talking to an audience member, too, finding that vocabulary to talk to that audience.
I think that's a great analogy. I think one of the most fun parts of directing is that every actor has his or her own process.
Yeah.
You know, they might be a Meisner actor or a Stanislavski actor, an inside-out person, an outside-in person. Ultimately, the director has to bring all those different processes into the world of the play in that particular production and figure out how to make that work.
Yeah.
When one person is off book by the end of the first week, and the other person is still calling for line into tech rehearsal, how do you keep the scene work moving forward?
Yeah.
And I think that's a great analogy for the institution in community.
In large. Well, and one of the great joys for us to be performing here is the size of the organization, because among everything else, on top of everything else, you know, we're happy to get Christmas Carol sloppy seconds, because we got some audience members in a couple nights ago who
wander into the wrong theater.
Well, they hadn't
Christmas Carol.
They acted as if they had walked into the wrong theater, and it looked like, because we can see everybody, and it looked like they weren't quite sure how to take what we were doing, and we made fun of them because they were late and whatever, and we come to find out, come to talk to them afterwards, they had tried to get into Christmas Carol and couldn't. but took the risk. Somebody at the box office said, well, you should go into comedy. We got some shows for the reduced tickets for the Reduced Shakespeare Company. And they came in, they tried it. It wasn't what they were expecting, and they had a blast.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly the kind of discovery that we all hope for.
Right. Yeah. So yes, please. We hope the Christmas Carol continues to do well, and we'll happily take what their sloppy seconds.
Well, we're happy. Yeah, absolutely. Whatever overflow we can send your way.
Yeah.
It is funny because what you guys do is so unique. Coming out of the improv and the sketch comedy tradition, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people don't realize that the plays are, you know, 98% scripted.
Yeah.
You have your moments where you go off and take little tangents or improvs with the audience, mm-hmm. but I was kind of surprised myself when you sent me the script for the first time to see just how very scripted it is. And of course, it never feels that way. That's one of the joys that the audience gets when they come and see your shows. And it's so different from a traditional play that the folks who come knowing that in advance are all geared up. You know, they love the RSC, they love the Second City, they love Saturday Night Live or whatever that is. The other people who are trying it out for the first time are the most fun ones to watch, like this couple you were talking
about. Well, and then we had another older than God couple, these two.
We don't have anybody like that at our theater. I don't know what you're talking about.
I know that's a lie because we can see your audience from the stage. But this guy had a walker, I mean, just classic, sitting in the front row of our tiny little theater we were going to trip over in the entire night. He came out and said, "Variety. You guys are variety artists. You would have been great 80 years ago.
The Catskills. There you go.
He said, I'm the only one old enough in this audience to remember that, but you would have been great. You know, he was over the moon with what he saw.
I thought you were going to say he was in one of those little carts. Like, remember in Mel Brooks' Silent Movie when they go into the old folks' home and there's that, like, antic chase with everybody on the motorized walkers?
We've had one or two of those, but this wasn't that guy. No, the audiences here in Cincinnati have been great, so they've continued to be great to us, and you are following in Ed Stern's footsteps by being great to the Reduced Shakespeare Company, so we thank you for that.
Well, I was just smart enough to say yes when you sent us the email inquiring whether we'd be interested. We're always thrilled to have you.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your artistic visions via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on many of our website pages, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans on our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, Director Matthew Croke, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout out this week goes to Anita Bridges. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Brian Dennehy, who's getting rave reviews for his performance in The Steward of Christendom at the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles, California. And thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 368 1/104ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Blake Robinson. Is it Robinson or Robinson?
Robinson. Is it Robinson? Half my credit cards say Robinson, so I figure if I overspend, I can say I'm not that guy.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less. So much less. So much less. So much less. So much less.